All right, good morning. 10:20 on Monday morning, July 13th. And we're doing Chem 3 lecture is where we're at. And what I do not have up is my chat or my participant list. And my camera's not on. So we need to fix that too. So y'all can see me. There we go. Good morning. Okay, we have now finished. I was kind of looking over the weekend what it was that I wanted to accomplish this week in keeping us on track and getting through all the content that we need to get through. And things start to accelerate here a little bit. Not too much, because we've put an emphasis on student learning as opposed to marching through the material as quickly as possible. And I always do that. I tend to put learning above everything else. But so far what we have done is we have finished, we leapfrogged chapter 5. Chapter 5 was the advanced theories of bonding. We went through that. We jumped into chapter 6. And in chapter 6, we had the molecular and empirical formulas. And we had the molarity, the concentration, different things. And so we had kind of finished out chapter 6 in molarity and the use of molarity. We did a bunch of different examples. Chapter 7 jumps us into stoichiometry, and that's where we will begin today. And we've already covered stoichiometry in the labs. And so I'll just do a quick refresher on stoichiometry, writing balanced chemical equations. And then we jump into classifying chemical equations. And this is where it might seem a little bit quick, because in classifying the different types of chemical reactions, they're actually combining a number of different types of chemistry all in one chapter, where they should be really in separate chapters. So we usually give them a little bit more time than we're going to give them here. But are we going to have an exam this week? Yes, I need to get an exam up as well, Autumn. Yes, I need to give you an exam, but I think it's going to be one where I'm going to send out, rather than on Canvas, I think it's going to be one like what you did with the nomenclature worksheet, where you work it on paper and turn it back in, because it's a lot of drawing and electronic configurations and structures and things that don't translate well to Canvas. So I think I may even send that out tonight and then give you guys some time to work on it. So yes, I need to get that done too, because I want to make sure that we get the second exam in before we have a final, so that we have two exams and a final. So that's important too. All right, let's start this chapter 7. I think my pen is on too dark. There we go. So chapter 7. And in chapter 7, what we have is we have balancing chemical equations. That part we've already done in lab, but we'll look at it a little bit here for those people who aren't in lab. Then we have classifying chemical reactions. And in classifying the chemical reactions, they go through acid-base, double displacement. Those are our solubility reactions that we've been doing in lab. They also hit redox and combustion. So we'll hit those. And then they get into stoichiometry and reaction yields. With reactions and reaction yields. So those are the last parts that we'll hit. When is the final? The final's on the last day of class. And I'll put that final out probably on the last day of class and give you guys through the weekend to finish it. And so the final is, we've got, it's a 6-week class. We've got 2 weeks left. So that's where we're at. All right, balancing chemical equations. Let's start with that piece. What we said here with the balancing is that that when we have a chemical equation, A plus B goes to make C plus D, that the mass has to be balanced on both sides. And that this is a matter of conservation of matter. In that matter cannot be destroyed or created. And so the equations that we use must be balanced on both sides of the equation. And the way that we balance those are with the coefficients. So the coefficients are numbers that we place in front of these. And these numbers that we place in front are used to balance the equation. And those numbers we call coefficients. Sometimes they're called molar coefficients. So molar coefficients are also the way that we refer to those, meaning that these are measurements of moles, or we think of these as measurements of moles. So the coefficients count as either single molecules in a molecular interpretation, or as moles in a larger sense. We tend to focus on them as moles more than we do as single molecular coefficients. So we like to think of these as molar coefficients. And when we balance, the rules are that you may only change the coefficients. And I had a set of rules that I had given everybody in lab. And I know that there's a lot of people that are asynchronous that are following that are not in lab. So I need to back up just a little bit. And you guys that have had lab with me, this will be just a little bit redundant. But rules for balancing. And then we'll show an example or two. And then we'll head off onto our next thing. Rules for balancing. Number one, you may only change the coefficients. Number two, start left to right. Balancing any element that does not appear more than three times. In the reaction. Number three, save diatomics for last. A diatomic, these are diatomic elements. These are things like O2, H2, N2. Cl2, things that appear as twos, but also we could throw in there things like S8, which is not really diatomic, it's octatomic, but it appears no more than three times. Wait, octatomic, but it only has one element symbol, and that's the main thing that we're saving, is saving the diatomics for last. Along with saving diatomics for last, what we want to do is you may use a fractional coefficient to balance a diatomic. So you may use a fractional coefficient to balance an odd number of diatomics, but you must clear the fraction at the end. And that's pretty much all the rules. The morning lab the other morning got to see me struggle last week with a particularly difficult balancing problem. And I went back, and played with that problem and found another way to balance it that goes beyond my rules, but allows me to do it in four steps or less. And by following these rules, what I like to say is that these rules, you should be able to balance any equation in four steps or less. And if you're taking more than four steps, then what you want to do is somebody wanted me to go up to molar coefficients. So I'm going to go up there while I'm doing that. If you're taking more than four steps, if you're finding that you're bouncing around a lot, you may want to stop, check the problem, make sure that you've copied the problem correctly. If you copied the problem correctly, stop and recount everything, and make sure that your counts were not off. Go back and check your initial count and make sure that your initial counts were all on. Those are the main keys, that most of the time, if it's taking more than four steps, you've either copied the problem wrong or you've counted wrong somewhere in the middle of the problem. And you need to stop and sort of reset, recount, and then get back on track. And that's where things can go wrong. Okay, so these rules for balancing. Let's take an example. One of the things that that we like to balance are sort of combustion problems that, like the combustion of methane, C4 plus oxygen goes to form CO2 and H2O. And when I balance these problems, I like to make a list of each of the elements in the problem. And then I go through and I count how many of each element there are on each side. And I repeat that list from the reactant side and the product side and make the same list of elements. Then I start from left to right, working my way. Carbon appears in only two places. It's balanced. Skip carbon. Hydrogen appears in only two places. Hydrogen is out of balance. Let's fix it. We fix it by placing a coefficient in front of the water molecule that multiplies to everything in the water molecule, changing the count of not only the hydrogen, but also the oxygen. So we had two oxygens plus another two, total is four. So every time you change something, you must go back and recount every element for that side. Now, if you noticed, we've got carbon balanced, hydrogen balanced, oxygen is out of balance. We need two more over here. So we come and we'll put a coefficient that will multiply by that piece that will change that to four. And the entire equation now balances one and one, four and four, four and four. And the equation is balanced. So typically, after I do all my work, I will also rewrite the equation. This is not absolutely needed, but it's nice to have the equation all written out in its balanced form without all the rest of the work going on. And then a balanced chemical equation is extremely important. A balanced chemical equation, the only time that we can do stoichiometry or we can do other sorts of chemical calculations, they all stem from a balanced chemical equation. If the equation's not balanced, then the stoichiometry calculations that you perform are not valid. So stoichiometry . These are mass to mole conversions. Are only valid with a balanced chemical reaction. So you might ask the question, well, why don't they just come balanced? Why aren't I just given the chemical equations balanced? And the answer is because when we do a chemical reaction, we must, as chemists, balance the chemical reaction based on the products that come out of it. So a chemical reaction, when you add things together, we don't initially know what the balance of that chemical reaction is going to be. It's not until we actually look at the products and analyze the products that we can then go through and write a balanced equation. But it's the process of balancing that is the chemist's job, to balance the chemical reaction. And it is true that in a textbook sense or in a problem sense, we could always give you a balanced chemical equation because we've always done that work ahead of time. But part of learning to do chemical reactions and part of working in a laboratory is learning that when you have a new chemical reaction, how do I go through and balance it? And why is it important to balance it? Because if I want to do any sort of calculations of how much product do I expect to get out of this chemical reaction, how much starting materials do I need in order to run a chemical reaction, those all stem from a balanced chemical reaction. So you can think of the balanced chemical reaction as like a balanced recipe, like for cookies or cake or anything else, that balanced recipe tells you how much of each item needs to go in it. Same sort of way, a balanced chemical equation tells you how many of each reactant needs to go in it and how much of each product I'm going to get coming out. And those are the coefficients that are telling us that. And they're based in molar coefficients. They're counted values, whole number values. They may not be fractional. Okay, so let's look at another example. Let's say that we want to combust something bigger. And we'll just do another combustion, for example. And this time, let's combust acetic acid. Acetic acid is HC2H3O2, and we'll combust it with oxygen, forming CO2 and H2O. Combustion reactions always have the same look to them. In a combustion reaction, it is always taking and reacting whatever it is you're about to burn with oxygen, and you always produce carbon dioxide and water. Unless the thing you're burning has sulfur or nitrogen or other elements in it, in which case we would get sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide. We could get some other byproducts that come out of these combustions. But combustion in general always looks the same way. We have carbon. The order is not important in the way that we make our list. Carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. The only thing that's important is that you keep the list in the same order in the reactants and the products. Counting the carbons, there are 2, hydrogens 4, oxygens 4. Carbons, there are 1, hydrogens 2, and oxygen 3. The first element that's out of whack is carbon, so I'll go and I'll fix it, and I'll change that by putting a 2 coefficient there that multiplies by the carbon and by the oxygen. So it changes my carbon count to 2, and my oxygen count to 2 times 2 is 4, plus 1 is 5. So I have 5 oxygens. Hydrogen is the next element that's out of whack. I grab the eraser instead of the pointer. Hydrogen's the next element that's out of whack. I have 4 and 2, so we'll balance it on the right-hand side by placing a 2 coefficient there. That multiplies by the hydrogen, but also the oxygen. So that changes my hydrogen count to 4. And my oxygen count, I start over, 2 times 2 is 4, plus 2 is 6. So my oxygen count now is 6. Last thing to balance oxygen, I come back and I save this diatomic for last because a coefficient in front of the diatomic changes only that element, does not spoil the rest of the balancing work that I've done already. So I'll change this coefficient. I have 2 here. I need 4 to come out of this in order to get 6. 2 plus 4 would be 6. So to get 4 out of here, I will use a 2 coefficient. That is the third thing that I've changed. That gives me 2 times 2 is 4, plus 2 is 6. And the entire equation is now balanced. So I'll rewrite that. HC2H3O2 plus 2O2 goes to form 2 carbon dioxides and 2 water. And I said that this can be thought of as sort of molecular coefficients. In other words, this is 1 molecule of acetic acid plus 2 molecules of oxygen go to form 2 molecules of carbon dioxide and 2 molecules of water, or they could be molar coefficients. 1 mole of acetic acid plus 2 moles of oxygen make 2 moles of CO2 and 2 moles of water. So the coefficients can be thought of as molecular coefficients or as molar coefficients, and they work both ways. All right, one more example. I'll do one where I get an odd number and show you the odd number sort of rule. Let's do, does acetone come out? I think methanol comes out odd. Let's do ethanol or propanol. Propanol would be good. C3H8O plus O2. Goes to form CO2 and H2O. We could show some other types of equations too. It's just that these are fairly convenient and the process doesn't change. But these are easy to make up. 3 carbons, 8 hydrogens, 3 oxygens. On the right-hand side carbon, it's 1, 2, and 3 for the oxygen. Carbon's out of whack. I will go and fix carbon first with a 3 coefficient. That multiplies by carbon and oxygen. So that is 3, 6, and 7. Don't forget that when you're counting, it is 3 times 2, which is 6, plus 1, which is the 7. So we want to make sure that we count everything on the right-hand side that comes down into the value there. Going and fixing oxygen, or hydrogen next. Hydrogen has 8 and 2, so we'll need a 4 coefficient. 4 times 2 is 8, but then I recount 3 times 2 is 6, plus 4 is 10. So I need 10. It's very tempting to come over here and put a 5 in front of the O2, because that would give me 10, but plus 1 would be 11. So that doesn't work. Eric, I'll check the question in a second. And so what I need to do is I actually need to do 10 minus 1, which is 9. I need to get 9 out of this. How do I do that? I do that by using 9 halves. And this is a balancing trick that you may only use on diatomics, that 9 halves times 2 is 9, plus 1 is 10. That gives me a total of 10 oxygens, and they balance 3, 8, and 10. However, I can't leave it this way. Fractional coefficients are cheating, and coefficients are never fractional. So what I do is I multiply the entire equation by that denominator value in order to clear the denominator. And I write out the new equation, the new balanced equation, 2C3H8O plus 9O2 goes to form 6 CO2. plus 8 H2O, and the entire equation has been balanced in 4 steps. So this balancing trick, use a fractional coefficient only for a diatomic, make the denominator the same, and use that denominator to clear to multiply all the coefficients by in order to balance the chemical equation. Okay, if you have time sometime, would you go over the chemical process of a hydrogen-powered car? Yes, sometime, not today.
Question, yes. Some equations won't balance, right?
No, all equations will balance. All equations will balance unless the equation is written incorrectly.
Heard. Thank you.
Yeah. And the one that I had that was really challenging, I almost want to show you really quick, just to show you how we can balance that equation and another skill set, another way to balance it. Although it's almost terrifying that I would bring this example back into class again. But I think I had shown it to both morning and afternoon classes. And so I might as well, right? Where did I do that balancing? That was on... here. No. I thought that was the bicycle image. That's nomenclature. I may not even be able to find it now. That's Lewis structures and that's Lewis structures. All right, I can't even find it. I'm just going to give up and we'll move on. Really didn't want to see that equation again anyway. All right. That was on Thursday, 7-9C. Now you're going to help me out. No, that's lecture for 7-9.
Yeah, I was in lab in the morning.
Yeah, 800 there. It's not looking like it. I think it was before that. 7-8-800. There it is. It was this one. Okay, so sometimes equations can get really challenging. And sometimes it's nice to have another tool in your toolbox to go through and balance chemical equations. And so I want to show you just another skill of balancing. This equation, you guys, almost all of you, unless you didn't have lab, saw me wrestle with this equation, and it does not balance easily. One of the things that you can notice is that the oxygens come in 3 and 8, that there are 2 times 3, which is 6, 7, and 8 oxygens on the right. There are 3 on the left. Oxygens have to entirely come out of this grouping here, which means that I need to have some multiple of 3 and 8 in order to balance all of these. And the multiple that we came up with, 3 times 8 is 24. 24 oxygens is one of the places to start. And that changes the count on everything. So it changes 8 hydrogens, it changes 8 nitrogens. And the hydrogens, the only other place to get hydrogens are out of this one. So I can come over here and I could say, all right, I need to get 8 hydrogens. I can balance my hydrogens over here. That's the second thing that I'm changing. And so that's multiplying through, and that gives me 8. And it gives me now 2 times 3 is 6, plus 4 is 10, plus 1 is 11. And then I'm stuck, because now what I've got to do is I've got to balance this and this. And oxygens are in all of them, and nitrogens are in both of them. And I don't know how to balance these two nitrogens in order to get 8 nitrogens, which one of these do I make what? How do I balance this? This gets very challenging. One of the ways to do this, a unique sort of way, is to take and say, all right, let's say that I have X and Y, and I want to know what X and Y are. Well, one of the things that I can do is I can say that X times nitrogen, and so this is going to be the nitrate that is here. And so I'm going to say that whatever, if I think about this as a nitrogen count, it is X times 2 times nitrogen. Does that make sense, right? X times 2 times nitrogen is how many nitrogens would come out of this. So I can say this is 2 times X times nitrogen. And then I'm going to add that to over here to Y times nitrogen. So this is going to be Y nitrogens. And when those add together, that is not what I wanted to do. When those add together, these two components, I will need to get 8 nitrogens total. So 2x plus y must equal 8. And that is my nitrogen count. The oxygen count, if I look at what's happening here, this is x times 2 times 3. So that's going to give me 6 for oxygen, right? Or x times 6 for oxygen. So I'll have 6x for oxygen plus y times oxygen. And how many oxygens is that going to equal? Oh, it's not quite done yet. Also, from this part right here, there are 4 additional oxygens. So plus 4 is going to equal the number that I want on this side, 24. And so what I'll do is I'm going to take the oxygen and the nitrogen out of it because they look like additional variables. But this is my number of nitrogens. And this is my number of oxygens. And these X's and Y's have to be the same in both equations. In other words, I've got 2 equations and 2 variables. And so all I need to do is I need to just clean up this bottom equation a little bit and say that 6x plus y, I'm going to make it look like it's a capital Y, equals 20. Basically, I just subtracted 4 from both sides. And then if I take that and say 2x plus y equals 8, and I subtract those two equations from each other, what I wind up getting is 4x equals 16. The y's go away as I subtract it. And x equals 16 divided by 4, which equals 4. And then I can take x and put it back into the equation. 2 times 4 plus y equals 8. Wait, something went wrong. What did I mess up? 12. I see what I messed up. I knew something was going wrong as I was doing that. 3. And 3. And 2 times 3 is 6. Plus y equals 8. Or y equals 8 subtract 6, which is 2. And so now I know what these coefficients need to be, 3 and 2. So I'll come back and I'll change them. This one needs to be 3. And this one needs to be 2. And I've done these now sort of, this was my third change and my fourth change. And I'll do my count now and go through and count everything. So as I go through and count, 3 times copper, 3 times 2 is 6, times 3 is 18 for oxygen, plus another 4, 22, plus another 2, 24. So I'm at 24 oxygens. and my count for nitrogen. 3 times 2 is 6 nitrogens, plus an additional 2, 7, 8. The only thing that is not balancing is the copper. And the last coefficient that I put out there is to balance the copper. And it balances now 3, 8, 8, 24. And my final equation is 3 copper plus 8 HNO3 goes to form 3 copper 2 nitrate plus 4 waters plus 2 NO. Okay, I will never give you anything that difficult to do. But what I wanted to show you was, while you saw me struggle with that the other day, it was only because I was resisting and going and using that technique of balancing that sometimes it's advantageous to use simultaneous equations and a little bit of algebra to find a solution that fits the two problems. Essentially what this is it formed two lines. If you think about it as sort of this way, it formed two lines that where they crossed was the solution 2, 3 in their crossing. And there was only one possible solution. And that solution became the coefficients that allowed the equation to balance. So it's not a skill set that I would necessarily want you to have to use, but it's a great skill set to know that you can use, that you can break out the algebra, and why math is so important and the math prerequisites for the class are so important, because sometimes as you get into Chem 1A, solving multiple equations like this are some of the ways, or some of the only ways that we have of solving some of these chemical equations, which is kind of cool to see. All right, how are you guys doing? Is that sort of a different walkthrough on that problem?
I have a question.
Go for it.
With back to the fractional coefficients from the previous problem, since we only do those with diatomics, is it safe to say that your denominator is always 2?
Almost. I could create a situation, and I'm not sure which reaction I would do it with. S8 plus, I don't know what I would react this with in order to do a proper chemical equation. But if I were to need a fractional number of sulfurs and they came in 8, I would want to put my odd number over a denominator of 8 in order to be able to get my odd number. And then I would have to clear the fraction. I'd have to multiply the entire equation by 8. So there are just a couple that are not diatomic, but that are molecular and have a bigger subscript than 2. There's sulfur and there is phosphorus, which comes in 4. P4 is another one. Sometimes they crop up. So it's not always a 2. Sometimes it's an 8 or a 4, just depending upon what that sort of diatomic or octatomic or tetratomic element could be. But you're using the same concept to balance it. Okay. Let's see. This is a good spot for a break, I think. And then we'll come back and we'll talk more about chemical reactions and the other information that is contained in chemical reactions. And then start looking at the different types of chemical reactions. And we'll go through all the different types of chemical reactions I want you guys to know. Sound good? All right, break time.
Be glad you broke up. Be glad you don't know what happens next. Be glad you're walking. Be glad you're talking. 'Cause who knows just what might happen next.
It's not that hard. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. Ah, check out the crabs in the bucket. Conniption fit when the microphone's lit. I take it high like a bird on a wire. Retire the fire, I never, cause I'm just moving on up. Choosing to touch the unseen, craving the clutch. Damn, if mirrors were created by sand, when I'm looking in the water for reflections of man. Understand the mind above time when it's empty. MC tragically hit, ahead by a century. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. Ah, check out the crabs in the bucket. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. Ah.
The risk we have taken. Dance with me. Dance with me into the colors of the dust. When you have awoken from all the dreams broken, come and dance with me. Dance with me into the colors of the dust. Dance with me into the colors of the dust. The paths we're walking on, they crumble behind us. The world spins itself down dust. I wanna be with you. I'm gonna be with you in the color.
Disaster. I might be right, I might be wrong. Try to get away.
Okay, coming back online. Let's see what we can do. Whoop. That didn't quite work the way it was supposed to. Now I'm working. Okay, and I need to stop that screen share and restart this one. Okay, when we start looking at chemical reactions and the different types of reactions that we can have, we get into classifying the chemical reactions. And let's do some information, chemical reactions in general. Number one, we always have the reactants, and they go to form the products. The arrow is red, goes to form. Usually, there are more than a single reactant and product. The pluses, rather than being addition, we generally think of as and. So it is read A and B goes to form C and D. Rather than thinking about it as a mathematical equation, that's the way that we typically read them. Sometimes, in addition to the reactants, there may be other information contained in the chemical reaction. And oftentimes we will list the coefficients as lower cases like this. So we have the different coefficients. Sometimes what we have are special conditions, things like solvent that go underneath the arrow, or temperature that go under there. Sometimes catalysts. A catalyst is something that doesn't participate in the chemical reaction, but changes the nature of the chemical reaction to a degree. The catalyst is written over the arrow. There may be other conditions that go here besides solvent and temperature. Time is another one. Or other conditions required. These are things like sound. They use a symbol for sound. Or sometimes it's light that is required. And so those types of things will also show up in the chemical reaction, and we'll see them that way. So we have our reactants, we have our products, and then we have conditions required to make the chemical reaction happen, such as catalysts, solvent, temperatures, time, or other special things that you'll see in the chemical reaction. Most of the time, what we do is we ignore what's going on around the arrow, above or below the arrow, and we focus mainly on the reactants and the products and their coefficients and what we need to do there. And out of the different types of chemical reactions, the different types that we see, so types of reactions, we see reactions that follow what are called the double displacement pattern. This is A, B, plus C, D, go to make A, D, plus C, B. These are called double displacement.
You wrote C, D.
Oh, thank you. A should be C, B. These double displacement are what are called precipitation reactions. These are the type that we've been doing in lab right now, are these double displacement reactions. In addition to those, sometimes what we see are reactions that are A plus BC goes to form B plus AC. These are called single replacement. They're a type of redox reaction, oxidation reduction. In addition to those, we have decomposition, where A breaks up into B plus C plus perhaps D. We have then reactions that are A plus B plus C go to form D. These are combination reactions. And beyond these four, the other one that we normally have is carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, X, Y, Z plus O2 goes to form CO2 plus H2O. And these are our combustion reactions. Now the book's going to throw a couple more reactions at us. And it's true that we do have a couple more reactions. Those reactions will mainly fit into one of these categories. So we'll see that when we go and do acid-base reactions, which are in this chapter, and redox reactions, which are in this chapter, that the acid-base reactions will fit in this double displacement sort of pattern, and that the redox reactions will fit in either the single replacement, decomposition, or combustion. And or combination. And combustion is also a redox reaction as well. So that redox really covers a wide variety of these different types of chemical reactions. And we'll have to see what redox is. But trying to get these patterns down as to what the different reactions are. And I was going to see if I could just show you a couple of examples of classifying the different reactions. And see if we can see what these different types look like. So let me give you a couple of examples. Example might be two H2O. Liquid going to form, oh, we should also do states of matter. Two hydrogen plus O2, where these are both gases. And so in classifying this, we would see this as the A going to be B plus C. And this one would fit the decomposition pattern. So this would be a decomposition example. We could see yes, this one. Calcium hydroxide as a solid reacting with 2HBr. 2 hydrobromic acid. Actually, I think this one was supposed to be aqueous. I was looking above it. Goes to form calcium bromide as an aqueous and water as a liquid, but I'm going to write the water as 2HOH, which is not the way that we would normally write it, but that's okay. Question.
Could you define aqueous?
Yes. Let me go through and I'll define all of those terms. And I'll say what all of those terms are. But in this case, let me do this real quick. And first, this is AB plus CD going to form AD plus CB. This is a double displacement. And so it fits the double displacement pattern. Okay, the little symbols that we're using, L, S, G, we put them or use them as italicized subscripts. The L is liquid, the S is solid, the G is gas, and the AQ stands for aqueous. It means dissolved in water. So these are what are called states. The state of the chemical, whether it's a liquid, a solid, a gas, or aqueous. There are other states beyond these, but these are the main states that we typically use within the class. And so aqueous dissolved in water. Yeah.
Is that AG or AQ?
AQ.
Okay, thank you.
See if I can make it clearer. So it's an AQ for aqueous. It's being taken from that part right there. So the aqueous, meaning dissolved in water, means different things depending upon what it is that is dissolved, such that we see that some materials, when they dissolve in water, such as sodium chloride, aqueous, denotes a molecule which has dissociated in water. So if this is the solution, then we're getting sodium ions and chloride ions dissociated in solution and surrounded by water molecules. So I think that we've spent time or talked about the how the water molecules will orient around these guys with the partial minuses towards the positive and the partial positives towards the minuses in the way that they orient around in solution. So this is what's called dissociation, where this breaks up into aqueous sodium cations and aqueous chloride anions. Some materials, when they are aqueous, do not do that. Some materials, for instance, ethanol, and I'll do it by its Lewis structure so that you can see the difference. So this is ethanol, and we'll say that this is aqueous, normally written C2H6O, AQ. When that is dissolved in water, the ethanol molecule does not break up. The ethanol molecule, I'm cheating, but effectively cheating. Sits in here in solution with water molecules all around it. And the water molecules surround this, but they don't break it apart. And this is what is called solvating, but not dissociating. So it dissolves as a molecule. And most importantly, It does not dissociate. So there's two different ways, two different meanings of aqueous. One meaning of aqueous is that an ionic component dissociates and breaks up into its individual ions. The other meaning of aqueous is that for molecular things, they stay molecular and they do not dissociate. Both things are aqueous, meaning dissolved in water. So that term aqueous really means dissolved in water. But when we see it, we use it for different purposes, or we think of it as meaning different things, depending upon what type of material it's applied to. All right, so we've had a double displacement one here. I'm looking to see if I can find a single replacement reaction to show you. A single replacement reaction might look like this. Zinc reacting with HCl going to form zinc chloride plus H2 gas. So this one, what's happening is the zinc is replacing the hydrogen, taking its place with the chloride and kicking out the hydrogen, which is becoming hydrogen gas. So this is an A plus BC goes to form AC plus B. And this is called a single replacement. So it's just pattern recognition in terms of the way that we look at the different types of chemical reactions. Go ahead.
Could you scroll up to the states one more time? I just need to copy that down.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in terms of classifying these chemical reactions, within this chapter 7.2, and what 7.2 covers, so chapter 7.2 covers precipitation reactions, double displacement reactions. And in doing so, they use the solubility rules. To predict the outcome of these reactions.
Is displacement and replacement interchangeable?
Yes. Yeah, we can use double replacement, double displacement. They're used interchangeably. Ayla, you needed to see the zinc reaction. And they use the solubility rules to predict the outcome of these reactions. Meaning, predict the products. So this is what we've been doing in lab recently. And the book has a set of solubility rules that are a little more complicated than mine, but I'm going to try to pick problems out of the book that are only going to require my solubility rules rather than trying to memorize the book's table 7.1. So they have those solubility rules in table 7.1. but I'm going to sort of truncate these and rewrite these again. So what we have is we have the ions, the rule, and the exception. And we made a little table out of this, and we said that group 1A cations these are sodium, potassium, lithium, and not a group 1A, but ammonium ion, which is the NH4+. These are ions that are always soluble. And they have no exceptions. And then, in addition to these, there is a group which is C2H3O2-, that's acetate, and nitrate, NO3-. These are always soluble anions. And there are no exceptions to these. And then within this, there are a couple of sets here, the halogens, chloride, bromide, and iodide. These are usually soluble. And a second set of usually soluble that has different exceptions. So we're going to put some exceptions into these, but this is a different set, fluoride, the last of the halogens, actually the first of the halogens, and sulfate. So this is how I remember the table, is I remember the table because I remember group 1A cations and ammonium, acetate and nitrate. Nitrate's pretty easy. The halogens, chloride, bromide, iodide. The first halogen, fluoride, and sulfate is the only other exception here. These are also usually soluble. The exceptions that come with these, lead 2+, is an exception to both of them. Mercury 2+ and silver are the exceptions for the top group. The bottom group has barium 2+ and calcium 2+ as their exceptions. And there's one last set. The one last set is carbonate, phosphate, and hydroxide, which are usually insoluble. And their exceptions are the group 1A cations, and ammonium. And the way that I have treated this table in the past is to color code it. So in color coding it, what I do is I take and I color code these things that are in green, group 1A cations. I think about green as being always soluble. So it's sort of like a green light, yellow light, red light analogy. If it's green, it's always soluble. And so here's my always soluble thing, and there are no exceptions to this. Acetate, nitrate, green, always soluble, no exceptions. And then I hit things which are caution, usually soluble, except when they're paired with lead, mercury, or silver. That's got to be a 2 on the bottom of that mercury. Same thing here. This next set, that's fluorine and sulfate. They're usually soluble unless they get paired with their exceptions. Lead, barium, and calcium. Notice that lead is common to both of the exceptions. Makes it a little bit easier, helpful to remember. And the last one is that carbonate, phosphate, and hydroxide are usually insoluble. They usually precipitate unless they get paired with the green group, which are always soluble, group 1A cations and ammoniums. And so I follow sort of a green light, yellow light, red light analogy. Green light, group 1A cations and ammonium, always soluble. Acetate, nitrate, always soluble. Good to go. These guys are always soluble. Caution, yellow light, usually soluble. These are chloride, bromide, iodide, fluoride, and sulfate. They have exceptions that will cause them to precipitate, lead being common to both. But in the top group, mercury and silver, and in the bottom group, barium and calcium. And then carbonate, phosphate, and hydroxide are usually insoluble, almost always form precipitates. The exceptions are unless they're grouped with a group 1A cation or ammonium, which have no exceptions. So any of those things always make those ions soluble. So a little bit of color to it makes the chart a little bit easier to read and a lot prettier formatted than what they have in the textbook as I'm looking at it. And then what we can do is we can use these to predict the outcome of certain chemical reactions. But before we predict the outcome, maybe what we should do is use this and show the way that we use this. When we play a game with this, what we do is I give you a compound and you tell me whether it is going to be soluble or insoluble. But it's not flipping a coin 50-50 guessing. It's quoting a rule as to why it's soluble or why it's insoluble. So we can take a couple of different compounds. Say perhaps we could take lithium chloride or iron 3 hydroxide. Or we could take ammonium phosphate. Or we can take magnesium carbonate. So we have a number of different compounds here. And we can go down the line and we can ask the question, is it soluble or insoluble? And then we can ask, what is the reason? So we can come back and we can add the reason to it afterwards. But let's just try to go through, whoops, that was not what I wanted to do. Why is this being so difficult? Stop it. Find the right thing. Delete. Ah, got it. Okay. Let's just decide soluble or insoluble first. And then we'll come back and we'll put reasons to each of these. So the first one, if we look at the solubility rules, do we expect lithium chloride to be soluble or insoluble? Insoluble meaning precipitate, soluble meaning remaining aqueous.
Soluble.
So I'm hearing a soluble, and I'm also seeing in the chat insoluble. Nope, Eric's changing. Soluble rather. And Karina is saying soluble. So yes, soluble. We would expect lithium chloride to be soluble. If we wanted to cite a reason for that, what we would say is we look at the chloride and we look at lithium. We say chloride is here. Chloride is usually soluble unless it's paired up with lead, mercury, or silver. Lithium is none of those exceptions. The other thing is lithium is a group 1A cation. So being a group 1A cation, it's always soluble, regardless of what it's paired with. So we could cite several reasons here. One reason we could say is that lithium is group 1A. Always soluble. No exception. The other rule that we could cite if we wanted to, if we needed a different rule or if this was a second optionary answer, we could say chloride usually soluble. And lithium, not one of its exceptions. So this is sort of an or. We could use either one of those rules. What about the ferric hydroxide or the iron 3 hydroxide? So first off, I look on the table. There's no iron anywhere on the table, but I can find hydroxide. And then I just have to ask, well, is iron a group 1A cation or not?
Insoluble.
Insoluble, yeah. So this one, what we would say is insoluble. The reason that we would state is hydroxide usually insoluble. Iron, Fe3 plus, not an exception. What about ammonium phosphate? Let's go back and look at the table. Ammonium phosphate.
Soluble.
Soluble. Give me a reason.
Because of the ammonium.
The ammonium is an always soluble cation. Perfectly good reason. What about the last one, magnesium carbonate? Let's go to the table. MgCO3. Soluble or insoluble? Max says insoluble.
Insoluble.
Insoluble. Okay, I'm hearing a couple of people. This one is insoluble. The reason is that carbonate is usually insoluble. Magnesium, not an exception. It's not a group 1A. Okay, so that's good. So you guys have shown me that you can all use the table. Now that we know how to use the table, let's look and see how we do a double displacement reaction and how we write the products and how we can go through and do the entire thing. So as we start to go through and do this, what we're going to do is take, and I'm noticing that in the textbook, they don't do this, surprisingly. Although they do have molecular and net ionic. So they are showing the net ionic equation. They just do it in such a truncated way. It makes me nervous. Okay. Let's do double displacement reaction. So here what we do is we give you the reactants and we ask you to write the products and then to identify which of those are going to be soluble, aqueous, or insoluble. I'll write that out and make it clear as we go through. So let's take a chemical reaction. Let's say that I'm reacting aluminum chloride with something that is going to lead to nitrate, PbNO3-2, and that these start off as aqueous. And we want to predict the products. So we're going to say, give the products of the following reaction and their state. Or AQ, solid, liquid, gas, or aqueous. When we mix these together, we have to understand the differences in the different subscripts. Subscripts here are extremely important, and there are two different types of subscripts to pay attention to. So when I look at these materials, I have aluminum, which is a 3+ cation, and there are three individual chlorides. The three that is here, that is a big highlighter, the three that is there is telling me that there are three individual chlorides present in this formula and is one type of subscript. The lead, being a 2+ charge, and the nitrate, being a 1-, there are two nitrates in order to balance out the charges, 2- to 2+. And so that nitrate, the 2 on the outside, is enumerating how many of the nitrates there are. But the nitrate itself can be thought of as a package in which the subscript is included in the package. And so the 3, while doing the same job in telling me that there are 3 oxygens within a nitrate, is doing the same job as this 2, telling me that there are 2 nitrates within a lead nitrate. But the 3 is part of the package, whereas the 2 is not. And so I need to see those two different subscripts as doing different jobs. I need to see this 3 as being fundamentally different than that 3.
And that's because that the 3, that 3 is describing how many oxygens there are, and the 3 on the chlorine is talking about the chlorine.
The 3 on the chlorine, so here's the difference. If I could make the difference as clear as I can. Nitrate is an ion that is a polyatomic ion that has a Lewis structure where these things are covalently bound. And that 3 that is there is telling me the number of covalently bound oxygens to nitrogens.
Okay.
So the 3 is a covalent subscript, whereas this 3 is an ionic subscript telling me how many of these ions I have. They were never bound together. There is no chlorine bound to chlorine bound to chlorine. This just doesn't exist.
Yes.
Okay. So when I take and recombine these on the right-hand side, I am going to combine aluminum with nitrate. And I bring over the 3 on the nitrate because it's part of the nitrate. And it will take 3 nitrates in order to balance the 3 positive charges from the aluminum. And I will write a formula, which is Al parentheses NO3 subscript 3. And when I combine the lead, which is a 2+, and the chloride, which is a minus, I will not bring over the 3 subscript because chlorides are individuals. And I will need to get 2 of those individuals to make 2 negative charges to balance the 2 positive charges to make a formula, which is lead chloride, lead 2 chloride. And so it's very important when I bring over a subscript and when I do not. And I need to see those subscripts as being different. I need to see the subscript of a polyatomic as being different than the subscript on a monatomic ion. And I know that's a hard pattern recognition right now, but that's what we need to do. And then once we do this step, so what we have done essentially is we have broken the reactants into ions. We have swapped ion pairs and balanced the formulas for charge. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to decide on state. And deciding on state, soluble is going to equal aqueous. Insoluble equals solid. And the last thing that we do is balance the coefficients. So far what we have done is we have broken it into ions, and we have swapped and balanced the formulas for charge. Now we're going to decide on state. So now what we do is we look and say, all right, what about aluminum nitrate? Do I expect this to be a solid and precipitate, or do I expect this to be soluble and aqueous? Find the nitrate ion and think about the table. We'll go back up to that table. And where is nitrate ion? Soluble, yeah. So this, in that it's going to be soluble, now I have to use my wording. Soluble is going to mean aqueous. So I'm going to change the term to aqueous. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a little AQ next to it, meaning that that is going to be aqueous or soluble. Now make a determination on the lead to chloride. Lead to chloride, when I go up to the table, I will find chloride. Chloride is here. Lead is an exception.
It would be insoluble.
Insoluble. And because it is insoluble, I will go back and I will look, oh, insoluble, I use S for solid. This is going to form the solid. And this gets the S. Now, what I have done is I have decided on state. And the last piece of what I need to do is I need to balance the coefficients. So I will take the entire equation into a different format. Where I can balance the coefficients.
When would you know to use liquid or gas?
Liquid and gas are not going to be used right now. Right now, everything is going to be either aqueous or solid. Liquid and gas, we would have to give you more information in order to be able to know what you're doing with liquid or gas. Some materials are liquids at room temperature. Some materials are gases at room temperature. And so if I were using water and it was room temperature, presumably that would be a liquid. If I were combining that with a gas, something that was gaseous at room temperature, for instance, HCl, which is a gas at room temperature. But these are not things that you would know or be able to predict. We'd have to give you more information. So for right now, we're not going to ask you to use liquid or gas. For right now, everything is either aqueous or solid.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so for balancing this, when we go to balance it, leave room for the coefficients. Just make sure you've got enough space to be able to fit a coefficient inside. Balancing these equations is very similar to what we were doing before, only it's easier to balance them by keeping the ions together, meaning polyatomics. Keep the polyatomics together because the polyatomics are not going to break apart. There is one aluminum, three chlorines, one lead, two nitrates on the reactant side. On the product side, aluminum, chloride, lead, and nitrate. There are one aluminum, two chlorides, one lead, and three nitrates. So here, the balancing can happen almost any place. Sometimes you may need to bounce back and forth a little bit, but it's not quite so bad if you see that nitrate comes in twos and threes. What is a, well, we don't even need to do it that way. What we can do is we can say, all right, no, we are going to need to do it that way. What's a common multiple between two and three?
Six.
Six. So if I want to get, six nitrates over here, what coefficient do I need to put in front of the lead to nitrate?
Three.
Three. That three is going to multiply by lead and nitrate. That's going to give me six and three. Let's fix the nitrate on this side. What coefficient do I need to put in front of aluminum nitrate to get six nitrates?
Two.
Two. That two multiplies by aluminum and by nitrate. That gives me six. Almost did the wrong one. And two. Okay. Now we can just go back and fix anything else that needs to be fixed. Let's chase the aluminum. The aluminum now has two. I want two aluminums on this side. So I will put a two coefficient. That's my third change. And that gives me six chlorides because it's two times aluminum and two times three, which is six. And I want to get six chlorides out of here. So my fourth change, that multiplies by lead and chloride. That gives me three leads and six chlorides. Notice two and two, six and six, three and three, six and six. The equation is now balanced. The total chemical equation is two aluminum chlorides, aqueous, plus three lead to nitrate, aqueous, goes to form two aluminum nitrates, aqueous, and three lead to chlorides, solid. And I used parentheses up here, but I didn't need to because it was monatomic. And being monatomic, it really didn't need the parentheses around it. I just got kind of carried away as I was writing. And so that's our balanced equation. The completed balanced equation.
Well,
okay. From this, there are several other equations that we can write, different types of equations. And the different types of equations give us different pieces of information. We did this in lab as well for the morning lab. The afternoon lab did not get a look at this yet. So this is just review for the morning lab for some bit. Roxanne, what do you need to see here? No, you need something else. You're trying to get up here? All right, I'm going to guess that you're snapping a picture and maybe that gets it. Okay. So from this, with these double displacement reactions, can be written in a couple of different ways. We have the complete balanced equation. And maybe for this reaction, it would help if I took this reaction and sort of showed what was going on in a molecular vision way, that if we had a beaker, and let's say that we have a before and after beaker, and in this beaker I have the solution, there is aluminum that is floating around in solution, and there's lots of chlorides, because there's 3 chlorides for every aluminum. And there's some lead that's floating around, and there's 2 nitrates for every lead. And so maybe I have another aluminum and chlorides that are floating around, and another lead and a couple more nitrates. And they're all evenly, freely distributed in solution. And that's what we mean by these aqueous symbols, is that these aqueous symbols mean that these guys are all freely floating in solution in the water. What happens is the lead starts to find the chloride. And as it does, the lead precipitates out as lead to chloride as a solid. And so this solid builds up in the bottom with this lead to chloride. And the aluminums that are in solution wind up remaining in solution. And the nitrates are hanging out with them. And so there are 3 nitrates for every single aluminum in solution. There's 3 times as many nitrates as there are aluminums. And they wind up staying in solution. And so the reaction really happened between the lead and the chlorides in precipitating down to form lead chloride. And everything else remained in solution. So we have some different ways of writing these. The different ways of writing these are called ionic and net ionic formulas. And there are 3 basic formulas that we look at. There's the chemical formula. This has the reactants and products. Shown as associated. And by associated, I'm meaning not dissociated. They're shown as associated, meaning written together. As cation-ion pairs. Cation-anion pairs. Then we have what's called an ionic formula. In the ionic formula, what we do is reactants and products in aqueous state written as dissociated. With charge and state. And then we have one more type of formula. It's called a net ionic. And the net ionic formula shows the reactants and products without what are called spectator ions. Spectator ions are those things that remain in solution. After the reaction. So we have these three different types of equations that we need to be able to write. And the idea is to take the equation that we've just written and show how we can write the ionic formula and the net ionic formula and how they match up with that molecular sort of vision and why each of these are important to use. So let's grab our balanced chemical equation. And we'll put it here. So here's our balanced chemical. And from this, we're going to write the ionic. And you need to leave yourself enough room, or you need to write small in order to fit it all in. What we're going to do is we're going to take the coefficient and multiply it by each of the things as we break it up to get all of the individual numbers of each ion. 2 aluminums, 3 plus, aqueous. Basically, this view up here, where was it? These numbers, there are 2 aluminums, 6 chlorides, 3 leads, 6 nitrates. These balanced numbers, these are the coefficients that I will use in my ionic formula when I write my ionic formula, because these are telling me how many of each one of these species I have. So watch as we go through and do this, how those numbers are the same. So it's 2 aluminums plus 2 times 3 is 6, 6 chlorides plus 3 leads. That should be a 2 plus. Plus 6 nitrates. See how what I did is took the coefficient, multiplied it by the species, and when there was a package like the nitrate, 3 times 2 is 6, gives me the 6 nitrates, but I don't also multiply by the 3 because the 3 is part of the nitrate package. So that subscript stays intact. I keep going, doing that same process for the reactants. Oops, products now. 6 nitrates. That's supposed to be a little AQ. There it is. And then the 3 lead chlorides, because this is a solid, it is not dissociated. Solids remain grouped together and do not dissociate. We are only dissociating those things that are aqueous. So if you follow what I'm doing, aqueous, 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 these are all split up into their aqueous components. However, whatever happens to be a solid remains a solid and does not get dissociated. That is then called the ionic equation. And the numbers, these numbers, 2, 6, 3, 6, these are coming from here. 2, 6, 3, 6. They're the balanced numbers from the balanced equation when I was actually doing the balancing. Once I have the ionic equation, then what you can see is that within the ionic equation, if I look at certain parts of it, for instance, the aluminum and the aluminum.
I'm sorry, I just have a really quick question.
Go for it.
How come we broke all, everything up except for the
solid?
Yeah.
When you look in the container, what winds up happening in the container is in the beginning, everything is broken up because everything is aqueous. But in the product, The lead chloride forms a solid and is not dissociated. The lead chloride being a solid is kept together, and we don't dissociate it because that's what it means. That's what it looks like in the solution.
Okay. So every time we do an ionic equation, we pretty much keep the solid by, like, we don't touch it?
You don't touch the solid. You keep the solid together.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So notice that aluminum appears the same on both sides. And the other thing that appears the same on both sides is nitrate. So nitrate also here, maybe in a slightly different color. Those two colors are very hard to discern between each other. Maybe doing darker. That's a little better. I didn't want to get crazy because I don't want to cut into some of my other color palettes. Maybe we'll do blue. That's easier to see anyway. These things are what are called spectator ions. They appear on both sides of the equation in the exact same way. The definition of a spectator ion is an ion that does not participate in the chemical reaction. It's like a spectator at a sporting event. Somebody sitting in the bleachers. They have no part in the game. They don't play in the game at all. All they do is sit and cheer the game on. And if we look at this reaction, our spectator ions, I think I chose this color for the aluminum. Our spectator ions were the aluminum, which are still present here, and these nitrates, which are not precipitating out. Everything else is precipitating out, and these guys haven't changed. They're the same on both sides of the reaction. So being the same on the both sides of the reaction, these are our spectator ions, and they're not taking part in the chemical reaction. So the net ionic drops out the spectators. It shows just what is changing in the chemical reaction. It is the three leads reacting with the six chlorides to produce three lead chloride. And this could be reduced even further to be just a single lead plus two chlorides. Which goes to form one lead chloride. Should be a two there in the subscript.
So you're kind of treating it like an empirical formula?
Yeah, almost. In essence, what happens is when we do the net ionic, these numbers should always be the lowest whole number ratios. And so we should reduce it down to 1 to 2 to 1 so that we get the lowest possible whole number ratios. I would take either answer, but it's important to see that we should reduce it down. And so we have the chemical equation, which shows everything in the chemical reaction. We have the ionic, which shows sort of a molecular view and shows you all of the individual ions that are dissociated and the solid that is being formed, which is associated. And then we have the net ionic, which shows just the thing that is changing and is really at the heart of the chemical reaction of what is taking place. We use those different equations for different purposes. And their purposes really are about whatever it is we want to talk about, whether we're talking about the entire equation and the reactants and products, or whether we're talking about this dissociated view and thinking about things in solution, Or sometimes we want to look at just what is changing and be able to look at the net ionic equation. So there are all three different views. And the three views are important to be able to interchange back and forth. So we've pretty much covered all of the double displacement reaction. The next reaction that they go through in this chapter is the acid base. And we'll see that the acid base follows double displacement and can be written in the three similar chemical equations of chemical formula, net ionic formula, chemical, ionic, and net ionic formula, and that we could do that for the acid-base reactions as well, and that the acid-base reactions follow very closely this same pattern. And I think that that's why they're really thrown in here together in this sort of reaction. So that's what we'll pick up with and do tomorrow when we come back, is we'll pick up with the acid-base stuff and look at those. Okay. How are you guys doing as a sort of second time through that material for the morning lab? Afternoon lab, it's their first chance through it. But the afternoon lab, we'll go through this more this afternoon. And so if anybody wants more practice with these, I would say go ahead and jump in on the afternoon lab and we can get a little bit more practice on these. Okay? Any questions come up? Anybody want to hang on the line and ask me anything before we go to lunch?
I do.
Okay.
But it's not about this.
Okay. Well, let's put it this way. Everybody who wants to take off, I will see you guys either in the afternoon lab or I'll see you tomorrow morning. Why is my camera off again? I hate when my camera's off. I know. You guys should tell me. That's annoying. And I did all these great things where I was looking at the camera, I was talking to it, I was imploring to the camera, I was begging you to understand. I was gesticulating and doing great motions and you all missed it. You missed all of it.
Missed the whole thing.
You missed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. All right, that's fine. I don't care. I'm not hurt or injured in any way. Good. Carrie, what's your question?
I think I had emailed you about noble gas notation.
Yeah. Okay. It comes down to practice and periodic table. And
I think I'm scared of it.
You're scared of it.
Yeah.
Don't be scared of it.
Can I ask a quick unrelated question?
You mean unrelated to electronic configurations, but probably more related to what we were doing this morning?
It's unrelated to everything, but it's actually related to a question that Kerrigan asked the other day at the end of class. Unrelated.
Okay.
Just real quick, this is my first online class, and based on the information you gave just about the next year being online, are most teachers like you, do you get to take this class, well, future classes, will they be able to be done asynchronously like you're doing as well?
It is entirely independent. It is going to be immensely frustrating for students.
Okay.
What you're going to find is that I've been talking to the dean already and trying to encourage the dean that we need to encourage faculty to teach synchronously as much as possible while allowing for asynchronous.
Yeah.
What most faculty, what they are doing is because they're going online, they are going to be able to completely move their class times around to whatever time they want. So basically, when in the catalog, there will be a class time. The instructor no longer has to adhere to that class time.
What?
Because the class will be completely asynchronous.
Wow.
And so they will be able to move their lectures or their office hours or anything they want to whatever time they want. And it's going to create chaos. Wow. And they need to sort that out like immediately.
Yeah, and I asked that not only because wondering about teachers, I have kids and yeah. They're trying to figure out, you know how that's going with them trying to figure out the school schedule.
Right.
I'm signed up for classes, but I'm hoping I can take them.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the problem is that we are entering a period of great chaos. You have instructors that have very different technological capabilities. So you have some instructors that that are going to be using cameras and filming their lectures on paper, that they're doing on paper with the camera over their shoulder. You have some people who are using iPads like I do. You have some people who have the ability to record their lectures and put them up in a separate location like I do, or some people that are just going to put them up on YouTube and you're going to have to go find them on YouTube and hopefully they'll link to them through Canvas. You will have people that will do synchronous lectures and then post the material to be asynchronous. You will have people who will just do it totally asynchronous and off times and everything in between. And I don't even know what to tell you.
Okay. Well, that's helpful.
Yeah. So what Cabrillo is doing is that if the class is synchronous, then they are asking them to be very specific about what is synchronous in the class and what the requirements are going to be so that it will be posted in the catalog. So when you look at the catalog, you will see synchronous tests, synchronous quizzes, synchronous whatever components, so that you know what components are synchronous. And if a class is completely asynchronous, then there won't be anything in the catalog. And it will be assumed then that you will have flexibility to be able to do everything that you need to do asynchronously.
Okay. And that's in the catalog now?
In the catalog, no, not yet, because they're still getting instructors to give them that information. So they're still requesting the instructors to put that information into the catalog. And instructors have not entirely done it yet because it happened too fast. Yeah. It was last week and they said last week we needed ASAP now, but they gave it to us like on, I don't know, Wednesday or Thursday, and said they need it now. And so all the instructors are on vacation,
yeah,
or trying to get their classes together and may not even see that for a week or two before they even reply to it.
Wow. Would you recommend emailing teachers?
Yeah, I would try to, yes, email the instructor and try to pin them down as to what their expectation for the class is. Yeah. And be specific, like if you need flexibility,
yeah,
you can say, I may not be able to attend synchronously all of these classes. Are there allowances for me to be able to complete asynchronously? And specifically, what about tests? Are you going to have the requirement that I need to take a test in a very specific period of time in a 2-hour window? And is there any flexibility to take it at a different time in a different window?
Yeah. Okay. Kerrigan, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. But
it's all good.
Kerrigan needed that too.
I know.
That was good info.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that it's so chaotic, but we're in a new area and the administration hasn't thought through all of the ramifications about what they're about to do. And the problem is that Cabrillo has spent a tremendous amount of time creating what is called block scheduling, so that physics, chemistry, biology, engineering, we have all coordinated our classes so that our classes do not overlap and that there are clear pathways which students can take physics at the same time as chemistry, at the same time as biology, so that the classes don't overlap each other. When we go into this format that is like the Wild West, where everybody can do asynchronous and move their classes to whatever time frame they want to lecture, it blows the block scheduling. And some people may not be able to continue to be able to take all those classes synchronously, and yet the instructors may still require them to be synchronous. And so that leaves me with great concerns about students being able to take all the classes that they need to take in the regular block ways that we do it. So I think that they need to tell instructors, hey, if your class is scheduled for this time, unless you have a really good reason why, you should hold your class at that time and make it be synchronous, but allow for asynchronous. So post the lectures and give people flexibility in the exams and let's make it work for everybody, but don't screw it up for everybody, I think is my message.
That'd be nice.
Anyway.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, that's the thought process. Okay, Kerrigan, let me show you on a periodic table.
Okay.
I need to
grab. You should just chair the science department.
I used to.
Well, come on, man.
They kicked me out. They don't like me. They don't like me.
They don't know what they're doing.
I tried to do things like cleaning up the stockroom and improving safety and telling them that they couldn't do certain practices anymore. And they got very upset with me and booted me out. So that's the way it goes.
Their loss.
Their loss.
Their loss.
Okay, here we go. Let's say that we want to do, let's say that we want to do calcium and we want to write calcium's electronic configuration. What we do is we backdrop to the first.
Argon.
Yeah, we backdrop to argon. And then we write out argon in parentheses. Yeah. And then only those elements that come after it, that was supposed to be a four. So it is 4S2, meaning 1, 2, and that is the electronic configuration for calcium.
4S2, so we're using that four because that is row four?
Because that's period four.
Period four.
So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. 5, 6, 7. These are the 3Ds, the 4Ds, and back up into the 4Ps and 5Ps. And I won't ask you below that. So that's as far as I go. So let's say that we want to do element, let's change the pattern and say that what we want to do is element SE.
We'd also be using argon?
We'd also use argon. That's right. So we fall back to argon.
Okay.
You fall back to the previous noble gas, and SE is going to equal argon and everything that comes after it. So we start off back over here and we list the 4S2. So it's 4S2. We list everything in here. But these are the 3Ds. So this is 3D10. And then I'm into this section. I'm back into the 4Ps and it would be 4P1, 2, 3, 4. 4P4.
It's that part. It's this that I'm not seeing. Because I guess the way, like, I think I emailed you this, what I've been doing is, like, every time I need to do an electronic configuration, I write the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because I think it's, I don't understand the way that it's structured within the table. So.
Oh, that could be hurting you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely hurting me a lot.
Okay.
So this 4D, 3D, 4P, 5P, that I don't really understand what those mean.
Okay, let me erase that. Ah. Let's erase that and those. I'm just going to make it cleaner.
Okay.
And then I can send it to you.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the S block.
Mm-hmm. And I have all of these blocks written on my periodic table.
Good.
But I also, you know, I want to make sure I understand what's happening. So I don't just look at the table.
Well, but looking at the table is understanding what's happening because even I right. need to look at the table.
Right. Totally. but like, you know, more than just looking. So it has meaning.
Got it. Okay. I'm going to change this to red. This is where it steps down. This is the 3Ds. These are the 4Ds. The 5Ds. The 6Ds. These then step back up. When I come back. Trying to decide if I want to keep it in red because I'm distinguishing that I'm dropping down for the D's and I think I want to come back in black. And this comes back into the 4P, 5P, 6P, and 7P. And down here, these are the F's. These step down by two. This is the 4F and this is the 5F.
So are those, do they reference, row separation? So like, is everything in the D block 3D? And is that like the there? Okay, never mind.
What you're trying to do, where did I do the electronic configuration? I did a, it's not back that far. I swear, I created so much content.
in my notes.
But I have a, I thought I had a electron configuration sort of sheet that had everything out. Maybe it was somebody's question, like office hour questions, where I had written something out specifically for this. And I don't want to have to reproduce all of it.
It might have been me.
It might have been you. That's the inorganic nomenclature. That's a homework key. It would have been before that. So it would have been all the way back here. There, that's looking close. Yeah, this works. And this might even been something I sent to you. I can't remember.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So notice that when we go to the 1S, this is a picture of what the orbital energy diagrams look like.
Yeah.
And we go from the 1S to the 2S. And from the 2S, we go to the 2P.
Yeah.
And from the 2P, we go to the 3S. And then the 3P. And then the 4S. But the 3Ds are lower in energy than the 4Ps. So we go 4S, 3D, then 4P. Yeah. We step down here.
Yes.
Because these 3Ds are lower in energy than the 4Ps. The same thing happens again when we go 4S, 3D, 4P, 5S. After the 5S, I go back to the 4Ds, then back to the 5Ps. That I come back and I hit this energy level before I go up to that energy level. That's what we're seeing in the periodic table. That's what this different way of finding those energy levels is doing. But right now, what that's doing for us is that is that step. These are the four S's, then the three D's, then the four P's.
Oh.
That's why it steps down.
So it's okay. So that, I was not able to articulate, but that's a reference to the orbitals.
That's right.
And those are places that are indicating a change in the orbital structure.
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And so while we're at the four S's here,
yeah,
we step down to the three D's and then we come back up to the four P's, correlating with that energy diagram.
And we knew we were at 4S's because here's the 1, so that's our 1S, and then there's the 2, and that's 2S, 2P, and then 3S, 3P, and then 4, and then we go 3D.
That's right.
Oh, okay. That kind of makes sense to me.
And so you can really just read it. If you pick a noble gas,
mm-hmm.
we can read it. This is argon 4S1, argon 4S2, argon 4S2, 3D1. Argon, 4S2, 3D2. I can literally read from the noble gas, just picking up the elements to go to wherever I need to go to use that noble gas core.
So, okay. Okay.
And I can write it out long ways. And in writing out long ways, I just take and I can identify where the noble gas is within the configuration. For instance, calcium. If I look at calcium, I can write 1S2, 2S2, 2P6, 3S2, 3P6. That is argon. And what comes after it, the 4S2, this is calcium. Written two different ways, written out the longhand way, but then also realizing, oh, that's argon's electronic configuration. So I'll just slip argon in there and then I have what's left.
And that's argon's electronic configuration because here's argon.
Argon's so that, here.
Mm-hmm. So up here is that's pointing at my computer like you
that's
can
all right. see
what I'm looking at.
That's, I know. That's so okay.
1S.
2.
2.
That's
2S2.
Yep.
And then
2P.
2P, right, because, oh, wow, because there's 6 right there.
That's right.
P.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Oh, yes. Cool. And then that right there is going to be 3S.
That's right. 3S is here.
Oh, because there's, oh.
Because there's 2 S's, so there's 3S. Oh.
Crazy.
And then this goes back to 3P.
And then this over here is going to be 4S, and then yes. It switches to 3D. And these are telling me it's switching, and that's what I should know where they are.
Yes.
Yes. Cool. That's awesome.
You've got a great smile when you get it.
That's a good one. That's really cool. I didn't get that. So my last concern with electronic configurations is that every time I look at that diagonal table,
yes,
I don't understand what it's saying.
Then ignore it.
But I keep looking up all of these like YouTube videos about how to like make this stuff, how to make myself understand it, and okay. It's saying these shortcuts, and they all look at the table, and I'm like, I don't know what they mean.
So this diagonal thing.
Uh huh.
This diagonal thing is just something that somebody created that works. And what it does is it gives you the filling order. It tells you that you go through the 1S and then the 2S and then the 2P and the 3S and then the 3P and the 4S. And then you come back and you fill the 3D. All it does is predict the filling order. It's predicting this pattern right here. But you don't need that if you can read the table. If you can read the table and you know, hey, here's my 1S, here's my 2S and 2P, 3S, 3P, 4S, 3D, notice the color that I kept this, the color the same, so that this was principal energy level 3. This is still part of principal energy level 3. It's just, these are the 3Ds. Then I switch colors back and I go back to the 4P. Then I go 5S, 4D, 5P. This chart is doing exactly this. And if you can read this, you don't need this.
That's so cool. Because that's so cool.
That's why I tried to color coordinate it, try to bring it all together.
Mine color coordinated? No. Okay. That's perfect. Can you go back to that picture of the periodic table so that I can take a picture of it so that I can write that on my periodic table?
Absolutely. How about I just send it to you?
Oh, that's cool. That totally works.
All right. And you have this one that we were looking at with all the colors on it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you sent that to me.
Okay. So then I'm going to go back and send you this.
Yes, that is so cool.
Okay.
Thank you. I think that's all my questions about that.
All right, then I'm going to go get some lunch.
Okay, go get some lunch. Thank you so much. I'll see you tomorrow.
Welcome. Okay.
Bye.
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 Bye-bye.